topical movement today. Good morning and welcome to our Sunday morning at the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. Briefly, we are an association of students with one common bond, which is to broadcast the principles of the philosophy of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, and to put those principles in practice in our lives. And this, we are told, results in a deeper understanding of ourselves, a truer realization of ourselves, and therefore a truer understanding of everybody else around us, and helps to prove to ourselves that universal brotherhood is the fact in nature. The Lodge recognizes everyone as a theosophist who is in true service to humanity without respect or without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, etc. And it welcomes anyone to associate himself or become a member if they find themselves in accord with the purposes of the Lodge. So those purposes really are very straightforward, and those purposes are to promulgate the teachings without respect to distractions of any sort, including internal, personal, political stuff and personality stuff. This is not a democracy with voting. There's no president or vice president or officers, etc., etc. Rather, simply, we're a family. Some of us are older brothers and sisters. Some of us are younger brothers and sisters. And that's how families work. So, welcome to the family. Anyway, today, this Sunday, by the way, the Lodge is sustained entirely by voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. There's no obligations imposed or implied, but however you feel moved to contribute is certainly welcome. The meetings that we hold here to fulfill the purpose of the Lodge are held on Sundays, on a Sunday such as today, from 11 to 12, and the doors open at 10:30. On Wednesdays, from 7:45 to 9, is a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy, and the doors to the Lodge actually open at 5:30, and that gives us 2 hours of library time if one wants to read the references and prepare for the class, or if one is pursuing a personal investigation into some theosophical ideas, you're certainly welcome to come and use the reference library on Wednesday evenings from 5:30 to 7:30. And of course, we also have a book table for those who wish to continue their theosophical studies at home. The books at the table are all straight line theosophical pamphlets and articles and magazines, etc., and they're made available to the public at no profit to the Lodge, so the cost is minimal. But everything that's found at the book table, it's our understanding that everything that can be found at the book table is also online for free. So if you look at the website ULT, Google Phoenix ULT in Arizona, and you'll find everything online available at no charge, of course. So this morning, our topic is the ancient and modern theosophical movement. You'd think I'd know that by now. Is the ancient and modern theosophical movement. And the way we will present it is in a panel form. We'll begin with the ancient and then pass the microphone to the modern. And after that, two very short talks, the floor will be open for discussion and contributions and questions, etc. So we'll begin with the ancient theosophical movement. And we'll start with the word theosophy. So often when we hear, people we talk to about theosophy, they say, well, what is that? And sometimes there's a tendency to just kind of say, well, Theos means God and Sophie means wisdom, so it's the wisdom of God. And then the person who knows little about it is like, oh, really? You know? So there are different ways to interpret it. You know, it could be the wisdom of divine things in nature. It could be the wisdom. What we like to do is explain it's a word that is the name of a philosophy. And it's called theosophy. And what that philosophy is a universal system of principles, of ethics, which descends to us from ancient periods, ancient races of men, from perfected in previous periods of evolution, and it descends in principle to us. In fact, the principles of theosophy have been with mankind since mankind has been on Earth. In fact, we are told that every human being has the principles of theosophy impacted in his character in such a way that it can be said, rightly said, that the principles of theosophy are inherent to every human being. So we have a lot in common with each other. And so from time to time, as surely as the sun seems to rise and set, so too does this philosophy of life find its open public expression, and at other times, not so much. It becomes hidden. Therefore, at certain times of the cycles, we find messengers or agents or members of that lodge of perfected souls who arrives on the scene to repromulgate the philosophy, to reawaken mankind to those inherent principles to his own character, and thus really to educate him. So a theosophical education is not so much learning new stuff as it is to doing something within yourself to create the conditions to recognize that it's already there. And it's just a matter of expressing those ethics, those principles, that way of life. So today, we're going to refer to the ancient theosophical movement as that expression of the theosophical movement that found itself promulgated in ancient Alexandria, Egypt, in the 3rd century of the Common Era. Now, this is at a time when Alexandria is known as the city of schools. Essentially, it's just universities of all the philosophies and religions of the ancient world are centered in Alexandria. There are other places, there's Babylon, et cetera, et cetera, but Alexandria is considered the hub. And a man by the name of Ammonius Saccas was born to Christian parents, but was never one to accept the churchianity of the time. In fact, it was said that he learned, you know, in his dreams, and he was Theodidactos, he was taught by the gods. So he established a school that was known today as the Neoplatonic school, and actually the system of philosophy which was founded is called the Eclectic Theosophical System. That's what it was called. And we refer to these folks as Neoplatonists. Now, the Neoplatonists were a large and varied group of students in Alexandria attending classes on a varied number of subjects, etc. But what the Neoplatonists, the Theosophists at the time, what their object was to demonstrate that all of the philosophies and the religions of the world were from a common trunk, were just branches and offshoots of one common teaching. And so it was their aim to reconcile the religions and nations under a common system of ethics. So this eclectic theosophical system was divided into three distinct features. First was recognizing that there is one absolute deity supreme deity or infinite essence. The second is the understanding of man's immortal nature, that man is a radiation of universal soul and is identical with it, with universal soul in essence. And the third distinct effort was something called thergy, or divine work, which was the art of using divine powers in man to rule the blind forces of nature. So during this period, the theosophists of ancient times were a large body, as we said, and they demonstrated to themselves and to the people of Alexandria that the ethics of Aristotle represented the esoteric teachings of Moses. They demonstrated that the Pentateuch could be reconciled with Pythagorean and Platonic philosophy. And they demonstrated that the Essenes, which some of us might have heard, might be associated with the character of the Gospels, that they were followers of Egyptian therapeutic or healers. And so we find some 15 centuries ago that these world religions were considered by these ancient theosophists all as offshoots and branches of one common wisdom religion. And that wisdom religion has been with mankind in some form since the beginning. And that this wisdom religion will survive all religions and philosophies as it did the fall of Alexandria, and it has now expressed itself again 15 centuries later in our time, and we'll have a talk about the modern day theosophical movement now.
Well, we certainly know that there is a modern day theosophical movement, otherwise we wouldn't be here. The truly modern-day theosophical movement began in the 19th century. But even before then, with Tsong Khalpa in the 14th century, he put an impetus forward for the coming forth of spiritual ideas. And we see that in the 1700s with the American Revolution. We see that in the 1800s with the personality known as H.P. Blavatsky, and there was rather a great deal of suffering, of pain that existed in the world in the 19th century. The Civil War had just really ended in the late 1860s, and there was spiritualism was running amok in the land because people were very much taken with the seances and the speaking to the dead and the moving of objects. And there was a great fascination with phenomena. But there was no real philosophy, nothing coherent, nothing that would explain what was going on. So in 1875, three individuals came together in New York City, an H.P. Blavatsky, a William Q. Judge, and a Colonel Olcott. Now, these three individuals, would say, met randomly. Well, as we see in theosophy, then nothing is random. That when H.P.B. first looked at Mr. Judge, he said that I knew him from somewhere before, and we had met again. And that there was something even grander or greater than the figures that were present. H.P. Blavatsky was a Russian. And the fact that she traveled the world alone, gathering information and verifying things that her teacher had told her, and to finally come and settle in New York. Now, with all the spiritualism going on, she made it her mission to clear up the misunderstandings and to put forth a true understanding of this ancient wisdom religion, because it embodied philosophy, science, and religion. There was nothing that was excluded from this understanding. So the Theosophical movement in this century, or the modern movement, really began in 1875. But it had never ended. It had always been an undercurrent of thought and of consideration of many. But HPB brought all that to a climax, brought it all to a head. And with her association with Mr. Judge and their work, brought into the Western mind the idea of masters, perfected beings, the perfectibility of man, that there are unseen forces in nature which are inherent in man, that those of like mind, like understanding and science and religion, like-minded individuals could form a nucleus of universal brotherhood. And they made these practical objects. And to do this, they felt that the study of all the world's religions and philosophies would help us better understand the oneness of all of this. Sort of hearkening back to that of Ammonius Saccas. But not only Ammonius, who was a Neoplatonic, but it was Plotinus, Porphyry, Imbicus. Imbicus was performing magic in the temples. And there were things that were going on that had sort of become an undercurrent. The Masons were a strong organization and very vibrant in the 1800s. And many of the founding fathers were Masons. But these ideas are embodied in Masonry. The idea of a creator or a principle, a oneness. So HPB met with a lot of opposition on three fronts, in philosophy and in religion and in science. There were those that everywhere she turned, they were standing to block her movement forward. But she brought in others a true love of life, of philosophy, of people, of humanity. And that was the fire that brought all of these feelings to the surface. So as the Theosophical movement began with the Theosophical Society, it was an organization, and there was a leader, there was a type of organization, and HPV was at the head of that. William Judge was in charge of certain parts of it, and these were the propagation of the Theosophy was put in the hands of these two messengers, and they have left behind a volume after volume of Theosophical ideas and texts that are a reference point for all. Well, what happened with this society is because it was an organization, that great weed of separateness, of personality, crept in, as it has in all religions, in all circumstances of life. That the personality is the one thing that we must guard against, must make it our friend and not our enemy of our higher self. But it was through this that the society could not function, because after the passing in 1891 of HPB and in 1896 of Mr. Judge, there were person after person looking to be the successor to these great teachers. And there can be no successor to these teachers. What is the successor is the thing or the information, the knowledge that they left behind, which has given us, each and all of us, a conversation with the masters, with those higher beings. They have opened that door for us to visit them, to talk with them, and for them to try to leaven the whole race mind, to bring it up to a higher understanding of that human quality and that divine aspect which we all emanate. Now, we must say that science, at the end of the 19th century, thought that they knew everything. They thought that there was nothing else to be learned. They thought, well, they'll just have to go back over the experiments that we have done to prove all these things, but there's nothing else to be learned. And HPB said that at the end of this great 5,000-year cycle of Kali Yuga, the curtain will be rent again, will be opened. And in this world of science, in 1896, 97, 98, radiation was discovered. Radioactivity was discovered. Radium was discovered. And electrons were discovered. Scientists of today and then said that the discovery of electrons have done more to serve humanity than any other discovery. Because with that has been the advent of radios and televisions and communication devices, of all these different things that were just all discovered at this time. There were many. There was a prophecy, in fact, that one of the proponents, at one point an advocate of theosophy and later proponent and an adversary, was Rudolf Steiner, and he had said that in his studies of Nostradamus said that there will be a coming of a new of a an old Hermetic philosopher in the 19th century. And Steiner had more or less pointed to H.P. Blavatsky. But there are so many ways that science has opened its doors because of theosophy. You know, Albert Einstein, you know, E=mc², you know, all these things, the atoms in perpetual motion, it's divisible, and matter and energy are convertible. Now, these ideas were not held by scientists then. But if you look in the Secret Doctrine, HPB makes these statements. And lo and behold, Einstein had a copy of the Secret Doctrine on his desk and referred to it quite often. You know, and the word atomic energy was first used by HPB in the Secret Doctrine. Also, genetics in the world of biology was was being discovered or uncovered as the and the idea of an astral body, electrical body, was being put forth by morphogenic fields, and there was an electric body. Science had was firmly convinced that that existed. And in science, they had looked into the stars and found this huge cluster of stars and galaxies. And within that, there seemed to be something drawing them in. And they called that the Great Attractor. And we as Theosophists know that there is that unseen sun, which the entire universe orbits about. Then we all can remember a day in the 1980s when the astronauts landed on the moon, how our the attention of a nation was glued to the television. And when the astronaut turned around and showed a picture of a blue marble in the sky, it became evident that it was alive. And that idea of life in all matter, and everywhere in space, there is life. And that this Gaia, this Earth, this living being, became a obvious fact to those who are willing to look. Now, while science was opening its eyes to the oneness of life, there were poets and men of literature and art that pointed to the secret doctrine, especially, and the Theosophical movement having greatly influenced their thought. George Russell, Yeats, the great Irish theosophist, they had met HPB, and they were greatly influenced by her work. James Joyce, his Ulysses. And then in the American and in the English scene of literary works were Jack London, Ian Forster, Howard Zend, A Passage to India, ideas, books that have made the movie screens and they become an event for our culture to look and to watch. Even D.H. Lawrence, he was infatuated with the occult, and he had wrote two books in particular, The Plumed Serpent and The Apocalypse, were two works about the Mayan Empire. T.S. Eliot, Thornton Wilder, Our Town, and of course, we all know of Frank Baum, the writer of The Wizard of Oz. Along with this, there was an opening to the world of Buddhism, of Eastern religions, Zen Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, Suzuki, the ideas of reincarnation, Edgar Cayce, who was a Christian until a theosophist named Lanier came to him with theosophical questions. And Cayce said, I can't answer those. I'm a Christian. But Lanier posed these things to Cayce in a trance. And the idea of reincarnation became firmly founded in Cayce's idea after that point of life. And we can't forget our popular figures such as Shirley MacLaine, who reinforced the idea of reincarnation. Elvis Presley, who has been the idol of many, but he, the voice of the silence. You know, the secret doctrine. He loved the work of H.P. Blavatsky. Jung, Frome, Campbell, Freud were all influenced by the work of H.P.B. So the Theosophical movement is alive and well in these rooms, in our minds, in our conversations with the world around us. We'll open it up for questions.
Yes.
Listening to the two presentations. traces, expressions of the Theosophical teachings. But then in the two examples given, Alexandria and 1875, we see something a little bit more startling, and that's the public effort to demonstrate the unity of all these religions and philosophies, which we don't necessarily see. So what are, there must have been other efforts, but in general, what are the objects, what are the primary objects of the Theosophical movement that we can recognize, whether it's in Alexandria or today?
So the question is, what are the objects of the Theosophical movement? In the literature, we don't think we brought it out during the talk, but in the literature regarding Alexandrian philosophers, it shows that they had the same objects as we do today. And those three objects are, first, of course, to establish the nucleus of a universal brotherhood. The second is to make a study of all the world's religions, philosophy, and sciences, both ancient and modern, and to demonstrate the importance and the value of that study. And the third is to investigate the hidden forces of nature and the unseen powers latent within man. Yes?
It seems to me that the work of the leaders of the Theosophical movement, whoever they are, is virtually insurmountable at this point, because in Alexandrian times, you know, ancient Greece, Persia, there were hundreds of schools of this knowledge. Prior to that, in Atlantis, you know, it was almost intuitive, that knowledge, or at least it was well known. Today's society is so firmly grounded in materialism that I can't fathom whoever's is driving this movement, you know, making progress in this. The few people we know of are just ones and twosies. They're tiny little particles out of the 7 billion. I can't see how they can possibly succeed with such grounded materialistic mass against which Theosophy stands today.
So the question is, you know, so how is this going to come about? How's the Theosophical movement, it being so relatively small, going to be able to affect the world, as is said? Well, of course, it only takes a little yeast to leaven the whole loaf. And the Alexandrian movement, while it's very interesting to read the literature of Alexandria, really, Theosophy, it was not all over spread broadcast immediately during that time. It had been the mystery schools in all the continents for millennia taught the one wisdom religion, but it had been lost. It had been way on the down cycle, and Alexander the Great, having been the son to a woman who was one of the few, our understanding is, deeper initiates at the time, while the mystery schools were on the wane, Alexandria he established in an effort to make an impulse, if that's the word. And so these, you know, who we call the Theosophists at that time, remember we were saying Theosophy is what? A universal system of thought descended to us from really ourselves in previous lives. So these Neoplatonists were revivalists of Platonic philosophy. We understand at the time of Plato, his writings weren't as fully appreciated during his life, just as perhaps in the 19th century people didn't see HPV's writings as having much credibility because of the ignorance at the time. But the Neoplatonists, a couple centuries later, recognized them for what they were and made a significant impact upon the world. Remember, people came to Alexandria from all over the ancient world and then returned spreading. Well, how's it going to, so how would we do it? How could we possibly do it in the modern day?
Well, it's rather interesting because it's stated in the philosophy that during this Kali Yuga, this age of iron and hardness, that the effort put forward in a spiritual direction comes back sevenfold. So, knowing that, and seeing how our world has been permeated with theosophy, even as, you know, H.P.B. was called the mother or the great-grandmother of the New Age. You know, the ideas of karma and reincarnation. I mean, these are openly taught and discussed. And 100 years ago, they were foreign terms. In fact, the Parliament of Religions of 1893, which was organized by Mr. Judge, first of all, the Christians didn't want to attend because their God was the only God, and they weren't going to talk about that. And then, and for the first time, the religions of the East were invited to the West, and this was never done before. And the Christians again felt threatened by these ideas. But the ideas are here. And as theosophy says, it is only for those who want it. These ideas are only there for those who can see.
And we'd also throw in there, you know, the New Age movement from 75 to 2000, let's just call it that, it's firmly recognized by in academic circles that that is the effect of HPV. It's rooted right into the efforts of HPV. And so, you know, folks who grew up in the New Age movement are, guess what, in their 40s and 50s now, and they have kids.
60s.
Then you didn't grow up in the New Age. You were already a grown-up. And they have kids. And, you know, it's talking to kids, talking to teenagers in high school today, karma is a given. That's a given as far as they're concerned. The whole bit about unity and oneness and all of this, that, you know, in the 1960s in Catholic school, that was the, you know, we're all children of God was a sentence that was recited that wasn't appreciated, recognized, or felt by a lot of people who were saying it. It's different today. It's different today. Yes, in the sweater. No, behind you. Yes, sir.
Yes. We are often victims of the obvious. And what theosophy is trying to show is look within. Those terms mean that we have to think about those objective things that we see with these eyes. We have to think about them. And if you go back to the early 19th century, and the later 19th century, when theosophy was coming on the scene, that's when you had the birth of advanced chemistry, biology, all these scientific things came out. And with the advent of the microscope and so forth, it opened up an entirely new world. And this is how they were able to see what the theosophical movement was telling you, that we are more than just what we see in the mirror, and so is everything else. So look within. So we had the invention of penicillin, various types of water purification, everything improved the health of man. Materialistic?
But the idea that the microscope was being used, but it's not the microscope just, it's the electron microscope, that they were able to look deeper within. And again, the electron.
And interesting, with respect to science and the secret doctrine, of course, you know, we imagine it's been a lot of fun for many theosophists through the the 20th century to watch science discover this when they've already been reading about it. We're sure that's interesting. But we think that HPB's first purpose really was the promulgation of the ethics of the philosophy. The key to understanding theosophy, the key to theosophy is really more the search within and the understanding of the ethics of. So we just want to throw that out there. So we heard one time that HPB is to science as Plato in his day was to philosophy, and that kind of struck a chord as well. In the white?
Going back to that original question, we would agree most of today's Western society is materialistic. However, in our time, we have seen more unimaginable tragedy, whether it's a tsunami or 9/11, unimaginable horrors. And yet, in the midst of those, people are running to these things to help others, to do whatever they can to without even thinking, I'm running into this. So although there is the materialistic side, there's also, we think, many, many examples, if we had focused on them, which we know the news really doesn't too often, the heart side and the altruistic impulse to do these things that if they had thought about it, I'm not running into that fire, but yet there are firemen who do that every day. So we have to also think that the balance is there and we can become part of that impulse to do good and get that tide going just in our own little corner of the world.
Thank you. Yes, in the blue?
And we were thinking the whole teaching of cycles are very important because cycles don't just start and then just end and something starts. It's a constant overlap. And we've been through many ages, the dark age as the deepest one, where sometimes the basic true teachings have to sort of go underground, but they're always there. And it's true, as was just said, we see a lot of a mixture going on now. You have the materialists, and yet you have people that are forgetting about just themselves and trying to work on the situation. So it's a blending, it's an overlapping that we need to think about too.
Thank you. Yes.
She read my thoughts. But I wanted to add something to that. It's about this materialistic society and that there are all these things happening that puts people together. A few days ago, I read a story about a woman whose son was the victim of a senseless shooting. And her son was shot and killed. And she was very angry and had thoughts of revenge. And she said, it's not going to do anything. Who did it? Whatever. So she founded an Institute for Peace to help people in senseless
shooting. In her son's name.
And
thank
I thought
you.
That was a wonderful thing. She probably never heard of theosophy.
Yeah. Well, that's
how much more theosophical can we get?
Well, exactly. I mean, it's we transform the universe in so many ways, and in so many times we have the opportunity by taking the wider view.
But those are the seeds that HPB planted.
Yes, sir.
You don't need to call it theosophy. It's
yes.
It's in the air, in the psychological air.
Thank you. Yes.
Once again, the theme of the materialism of our age, that the modern theosophical movement has to deal with, it can only make us wonder how much worse things would be if the efforts weren't made in 1875, which had all the ramifications mentioned from the platform. As it was our understanding that the efforts of the movement
Thank you. So the contribution here is interesting how this modern day expression most likely was put in place to protect modern day society from itself. What would have and could have happened? Well, let's take a look at what would have and could have happened by just looking at what did happen 1500 years earlier, which of course is the cycle of incarnations, generally speaking, for humanity. Well, if the Neoplatonic school, which was so universal, came to an end in the beginning of the 5th century, let's call it 400 AD, and with the death of Hypatia and the destruction of the library in Alexandria, and therefore the collapse of all the schools of Alexandria, along with that, as that collapsed, so too did Western Europe descend into the Dark Ages. And we know the horrors of the Dark Ages. In particular, we'll just refer to the ignorance, the lack of education, the fear of the power of the state, of nobility, and the superstition of false religion. So when the Theosophical movement declined, when Alexandria and the Neoplatonists collapsed, look what happened to Western Europe. Well, the Theosophical movement is the re-embodiment of that effort in the 19th century. And could it be that we learned enough back then to do other things today, because there are today forces in the world which are grounded in superstition and feed on the passivity and ignorance of the people. There are nations today which have complete, so to speak, control of the people and keep people in fear. And so this is a whole reincarnation thing. Perhaps the big difference today is the internet. Oh, what would have happened in, say, the Cathars? The Cathars who were slain by Dominic with his 10,000 soldiers from the Pope. What would have happened if the Cathars had social media to let everybody around know that we're being, you know, there are 10,000 outside our city walls, please help, you know? Well, they didn't have it at the time, but don't we have it today? And it's been effective in doing something, or we should say it has had significant effect on things, you know? So, yes.
But we just want to mention that even in HPB's time, in Mr. Judge's time, and after they had passed, there was great dissension. The personal idea was running amok. With the help and the vision of Robert Crosby, he put the Theosophical movement back on the right footing. He revitalized all the writings and all the articles that had been published by HPB, by William Q. Judge, which all of his work had gone, disappeared. But he brought all of these back and developed a program of theosophy.
Yes.
It seems as we look back into the history of Alexandria and the destruction, what about their demise was the uniting of church and state, church having the power of the Roman authority at that time, the might of the army. Well, we know beginning with our revolution, the principles of the founding fathers which separated church and state. And even in the Catholic Church today, with the present Pope, we don't think we can find an example of a Pope in such short get the church back to its fundamental ethics rather than its dogmas, emphasizing the importance of the ethics. So we think that's quite a revolution, or at least the attempt for a change within the church.
Thank you for the contribution. Yes, since
what? The thing today, it's wonderful when we can go back to our library and find the fairy tales we studied in our childhood and the various books on mythology and so forth. And our earlier statement, look within. And the Gospel tells us to look within. And when we look within, we catch some part of our individuality that does not want us to do this research. But if we keep at it long enough, it has to display itself. And its name is called selfishness. And here is where the ethics of the teaching give us the weapons and the necessary information to not fight outside, but to fight back within, to return to a more harmonious, balanced outlook. That's what we feel that we get from these teachers if we take the time to investigate.
You know, HPV pointed out again and again and again how man is the creator of the universe, and that there is a correspondence between man's higher nature and his perfectibility. That man is perfectible, and that HPV put humanity on a higher ground than it had been up to that point, because material science had degraded it, and the ideas and concepts which were being promoted, being evolved from apes and monkeys and all that, only degraded the race. It did not uplift it.
It seems, you mentioned the internet. I think of one of the most closed societies in the world was the Soviet Union in the 80s. Where no information leaked in or leaked out, practically. And the collapse of that society began with one invention, the invention of the fax machine in the late 80s, or thereabouts. And of course, once the internet came through, the total collapse occurred. So it seems that the promulgation of knowledge, which is what internet is the ultimate tool in the enlightenment of man, at least the beginning.
But there stands that one power of man. It's called discrimination.
Yeah.
No, that is where we always have problems.
So the what was mentioned is, you know, it's the promulgation of knowledge is basically what spreads freedom and awareness and everything. That's the point. People who would have power over others want to keep the others ignorant. Ignorant of what? Ignorant of who they truly are. Thus, you're a miserable sinner rather than the creator of your universe. And that's what the Theosophical movement is all about. To educate people in the Theosophical sense is to bring out from within them, to help, to show, to demonstrate that they've got it all, what they need. And it's up to them in any given lifetime to do what's necessary to create the conditions to be who you are. Yes.
When Theosophy embodies cooperation, and it points it out in all facets of nature, and we see that the religions of our world are destroying us because they're based on competition.
Yes?
The freedom to express and have access to knowledge or truth cannot go on unless there's also the freedom to express ignorance and prejudice. What we think one of the hallmarks of the Theosophical movement is, while giving out truth, open and tolerant to the expression of any idea or creed. It does not discriminate or separate itself from other human efforts on the basis of the ideology of one that tries to seek unity in all, or at least be tolerant of those ideas which differ from itself. That's very unique in the world.
Thank you.
One thing about HPB, again, that she was a Russian, and a Russian woman. She was a bit of a rebel. She wasn't classically trained or with universities and so forth. And she had all these obstacles that she had to deal with. But in looking at Russia after her time, how it has, with the Russian Revolution in the 1900 and so forth, the Russian people have within their culture and their mythology of that wandering pilgrim or that sage who would go from village to village, imparting knowledge and wisdom and so forth. And that HPB is now being embraced in Russia, and it's quite amazing the fervor in which the Russian people have identified with her, and Khrushchev, it wasn't always the best example of Russian tolerance.
and it was also quite amazing with the fall of the Berlin Wall, et cetera, et cetera. It was also amazing the fervor with which the Russian Orthodox authorities opposed all these foreign crazy religions coming in from the West. It was very interesting to see the lengths to which they would politically maneuver to get things outlawed.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes.
Declaration, the second page, top paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
We think public debate. The sixth, right on the second, not the latest, we recall the statement in that declaration that this was a new day, and that.
Do you mean the periodical, not the declaration? You're talking about a paragraph in the periodical?
The declaration itself.
Oh, okay.
The second page.
There's only one, it's...
Yeah. Is that the September?
This is the declaration. Are you talking about the period? No, this...
Yeah.
No, this is not September. Is
the second page, I don't know whether it's there.
Universal principles?
Yeah. Well...
Okay.
We'll just ask you to take that gentleman into the back room and show him. Okay? All right, well, we'll have to call the meeting to an end, but I hope you found these ideas stimulating and enlightening. But we'd like to remind all that this lodge, as all those lodges throughout the world, are based on a policy of independent devotion. So there is no obligation implied or inferred, but only that which one wishes to observe. So we invite you to become a part of the Theosophical Movement. Meeting adjourned.